You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
And welcome. You are listening to watching the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz. Well, Europe, a basket case. We see the dollar going ever higher, the euro, and all the other currencies in the Dixie Exchange, Dixie Index, go lower and lower. What does this mean for Europe? Well, let's get boots on the ground. Let's get the word from somebody who's actually there, experiencing this, observing it firsthand. Octavio Morenzi, Apimus.com. Octavio, it's great to have you back. So how bad is Europe? I mean, I was there a couple months ago. It seemed like Europe to me.
You know, it's still the same. It's still, you know, we've still got the churches and the museums and things like that. Those things haven't gone away. So things look pretty normal so far. I think we're seeing a few changes lurking on the horizon. Inflation starting to look worse and worse. I mean, there is a Ukraine conflict, of course, dragging on, but that does seem very distant from the day-to-day life, which where it doesn't seem to have that much of a direct impact.
Going through a major energy crisis there, if I'm to believe any of the publications that I read, potentially this winter. I mean, you've got Switzerland saying don't heat your home for over 18 degrees centigrade or we'll come and put you in jail. And I mean, what's a poor European supposed to do here, Octavio?
Well, yeah, my gas bill just got doubled. So I got a notice saying your gas price is going up, doubling. And so that's going to start to take a real bite out of our pockets as we look forward. I think, though, what is likely to happen, and we've seen it now already happen in Italy because they just had the elections, is that a group of politicians might come to the fore who are not as inclined to put sanctions on Russia, and might be start to think about rethinking those policies, and might start to rethink some of the sort of greener policies and more environmentally friendly policies. And for whatever reason, those two policies seem to go more or less hand in hand with each other. This desire to open the spigots again and get a cheap supply of energy going, because there is enough gas, there is enough oil. It's not a question of shortage of that sort. It's just a question of a lot of green policies punishing people for using those energy sources, and then also pushing sanctions on Russia, which will make things very difficult indeed. I mean, anyone who's running on natural gas is going to have a very hard time finding that natural gas in short order. So I think we're seeing maybe a bit of a political shift here more than anything else. And the bellwether really is the Italian elections that were just concluded yesterday.
Right. And that is a just explain to us what happened in the election there and why it's significant.
Well, basically, the woman looks like she's going to be the next prime minister of Italy, is what you might describe, and some people describe as a right-wing populist, sort of in the mold of Trump. And she has an alliance with two other right-wing parties, her own party, the Brotherhood of Italy. She's allied with Berlusconi's party and the Northern League, that is a party that has basically been calling for Italy to be broken into two, basically saying we'd like the North to make its own country and the South, they can go on their way and carry on doing the way things do things down in Naples and in Sicily. So she's poised on the victory and looks like she's going to move forward with a sort of Trump-esque kind of policies. So she looks very close to victory there. It looks like it's almost a foregone conclusion at this stage that she's going to be the next prime minister, and looks like on target to, with her alliance, to get an absolute majority in the Italian parliament, which is an unusual occurrence. Usually in Italian elections, you have all sorts of split parliaments, and there's all sorts of horse jockeying that goes back and forth, and everyone wants a kickback or a cut or seats in the cabinet and things like that. And it becomes a very unstable kind of governmental form. And this time looks like they've actually decisively won.
Well, it sounds like politics as usual, what you were describing. So it's not politics as usual. Maybe the good guys have won, but you know, the ability to keep a government together in Italy post-World War II has been very, very challenging. I mean, talk about political instability. Italy is kind of the kind of the poster child for that, isn't it?
Indeed, and I think it's basically tied to the form of elections that they have. They have the system of proportional representation, where you get lots of little parties, and everyone gets seats in the parliament based on how many votes they actually got. Now, if you compare that to the UK system, for example, is what they refer to as a first-past-the-post, sort of a winner-take-all kind of system, and therefore you tend to get an exaggeration of what the voting actually was in the parliamentary seats and how they're allocated. So it's quite possible for the Conservatives, for example, to win 51% of the vote but get 80% of the seats in parliament. It's actually even possible for them to get slightly less than 50% of the votes and still have a majority in parliament. That's something you see in US presidential elections, and something similar then works in UK parliamentary elections as well. But no, in Italy, yes, notorious for being unstable and having lots of splintered parliaments and lots of different parties. And I think it's as a result of that proportional representation system that leads to that.
All right. So it's a flawed system that they haven't gotten around to fixing, because obviously it's in somebody's interest to keep it that way, right?
Well, definitely. If you've come to the top of the system through that system, you're going to be loath to fix it because you're afraid that it will prevent your rise in the future. So it's very unusual to see politicians fix systems like that. Just like in the US, I think you'll never see, or I can't think of a scenario where you have the electoral college taken away and people just vote directly for the president. That would have to go through a constitutional amendment, and that would have to go through exactly the same kind of representation system that the electoral college works on. And so, of course, they're not going to take away their own power and their own representation in that process. So I don't think that's the kind of thing that changes. So yeah, once you put the system like this into place, it's fiendishly difficult to actually change it.
Yes, yes, yes. And then it becomes corrupted and it works against the people who are supposedly voting for their leadership. So on other news, other fronts, pretty much the Russian gas flow has been mostly cut off now to Europe.
Indeed, yes. So they've cut back severely on the Nord Stream pipeline, claiming that there were some sort of gas turbines that had been blocked that they couldn't repair. I think there might be an element of truth to that. I think there were some gas turbines that were sent to Canada, I remember, to be repaired. Right. And the Canadians put a block on that and said, no, you can't have them back because we've got sanctions on the Russians. And so that stuff got stuck. And the Russians said, give us it back, otherwise we're going to cut the gas flow. We can't repair them. So, you know, there's with all these things, of course, there's an element of truth to something in there. And that is the story that the Russians are propagating at this stage, basically saying, unless you lift those sanctions, you're not going to get any more gas. Now, the question then becomes, how long can the Germans stand that? And who can hold their breath longer? I dare say that the Germans are going to cave in more rapidly than the Russians, but that's pure speculation on my part. Who really knows who's going to come out on top there? But I think the Russians have perhaps a greater sense of urgency, feel more attacked or threatened than the Germans do, and therefore probably willing to clench their teeth longer and hold up for a longer period of time than the Germans probably would be.
Yeah. Now, we get a lot of conflicting reports on the war here in the United States, a lot of propaganda. A lot of it comes from the Daily Mail, which seems to be like an MI6 information outlet. And then we get, the New York Times, which is the Department of Justice's FBI's official organ, and the Washington Post, which is the CIA's subsidiary, news dissemination subsidiary. But by all accounts, Russia's not doing too well in this war, are they?
I don't know, honestly. I think you're right to point out there's so much propaganda out there. Now, I'm not going to say I support the Russian position or the Ukrainian position, but I think things are not nearly as bleak as they might seem if you read the Western media. So the Ukrainians have pushed forward into certain areas, pushing towards Luhansk and reclaiming some territory there. But I think it's always a mistake to try and hold on to territory at any price. And sometimes there's some worthless territory and you have to pick your battles and figure out what you're going to defend. But to basically, for the Ukrainian army to push forward into basically open terrain that the Russians can just with long-range artillery pick them off and with their air superiority there, bomb them into submission, it doesn't sound to me like a winning strategy on the part of the Ukrainians. So I think in the coming days and weeks, we're going to see that unfold. And I think it's going to be very unpleasant for the Ukrainians. I think it's relatively easy to push forward into a country with troops. It's very hard to keep that territory, and you make yourself very exposed to attacks and counterattacks. And I think that's what the Russians are basically planning on doing. So yes, come forward all the way, and we'll cut your supplies off behind you, and we'll bomb you. And we'll basically put you into a cauldron, and we'll start to pick you off one by one. I suspect that's what's happening there more than the victorious Ukrainian army pushing the Russian forces back.
Well, the other thing, though, is that this war has stretched on over 6 months. Russia believed by all accounts that they would just go in there, take over Kiev in a few days, and then just kind of erase the existence of Ukraine as a separate sovereign country. So in that respect, the Russians have failed miserably, haven't they?
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Fury Gold Mines is a Canada-focused exploration and development company committed to aggressively growing its scalable high-grade gold assets with major drill campaigns planned across its 3.5 million ounce portfolio. Fury is led by a management team of proven explorers and developers with a track record of success in advancing and financing project development. Fury Gold Mines is well positioned to create value for investors with low-risk development growth and the potential for a new major discovery. Fury Gold Mines trades on the TSX and NYSE American under the ticker FURY. To learn more, go to furygoldmines.com. That's furygoldmines.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
Yes, but I think, though, there you might be misstating what the Russians said originally in terms of what their strategic objectives were. And then basically sort of attacking that misstatement. Because if we go back to when this invasion started, Putin basically said he had a few aims. One was to basically separate or liberate the eastern provinces of Donetsk and Luhansk and those areas around there. And so that was a goal. And the other goals were to denazify the Ukraine and then to demilitarize it, meaning you don't join NATO and become a neutral country. So they've, in large part, I think, succeeded in terms of getting the eastern provinces. I mean, not entirely, perhaps, but that's, I think, largely succeeded. I think they've probably succeeded in terms of frightening Ukraine away from joining NATO, or NATO accepting Ukraine and getting into an open war with Russia over that. And then the denazification of Ukraine, I don't know. I don't quite know how to measure that or even know what that means. But I think
the first place.
If it isn't true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think there too, there's an element of truth to that, right? I mean, I remind you back in 2014, the Ukrainian election, they didn't call themselves National Socialists, they called themselves Socialist Nationalists, and they were part of the government, and they did have ministers in office, and they were basically openly a Nazi party and were part of the government. Now, they're no longer in the government, haven't been there for a few years, but certainly there are elements in Ukraine that are overtly pro-Nazi.
All right. Well, hey, like I say, it's really, really difficult to understand exactly what the heck is going on there, other than people are getting killed. I tend to think that this has been a real disaster for Russia on many levels, but whether it continues on like that, I don't know the answer to that. You know, they've just lost a lot of men and a lot of equipment. And I'm not saying by any stretch that Ukraine's winning. That would be a stretch. But, you know, wars are very expensive. They're very inflationary. So, and it appears sowing a lot of discord with this mobilization, almost full mobilization of the Russian armed forces, you know?
Listen, I agree with you entirely. Those things have a risk of being very unpopular, and a full-scale mobilization, certainly amongst those people being mobilized, very, very unpopular as well. I guess you have to ask yourself the question, is this unpopular amongst the Russian population? And I don't know that. I suspect this might not be an unpopular move. It's possible the Russians view themselves as being attacked by the West here. And therefore, yes, we support fully Putin's position and the full mobilization of Russia is once again necessary. Bear in mind, deep, deep in the Russian psyche is this sense that we are the place that the West invades once in a while. Be it the Crimean War, be it the Napoleonic Wars, be it World War I, be it World War II. This is just the place they like to come for whatever reason and invade. And we have to constantly be wary of that and mobilize, be ready to defend the motherland. And that is deep, deeply ingrained in the Russian psyche. And I think that might be coming to the fore too here. So a full-scale mobilization like this might actually be quite popular. And I think Putin is smart enough to read the political tea leaves within his own country to know what is going to be popular and unpopular and what he can get away with and not get away with. I don't think he's the crazed psychopath that he's portrayed as in the Western media. He's a very shrewd operation.
Cold calculating. On the other hand, this is not the time and place where I'd really want to be a Russian general or a colonel or a commander, because those people have gotten killed. There's no question. Of all the prop, agitprop, and disinfo that we've received, the one thing we can pretty much confirm is a lot of Russian top military brass have met their end in Ukraine.
I think you're absolutely right. And we saw this a few times in Syria, too, where very high-ranking Russian officers were killed. Generals and higher, and I think not just brigadier generals, but sort of major generals at that level. I can't remember their exact rank. But
yeah,
that is, I think if you're coming sort of with the philosophy that reigns in some Western armies where the generals lead from the rear, that looks absolutely shocking, and in their terms, looks absolutely awful. I think the Russian generals are doing quite a different thing and leading from the front, and they are right out there exposing themselves with their men. And sometimes I've heard Russian military say that they don't understand how American soldiers could tolerate those kinds of generals. That if we did that, we'd have a mutiny and we'd have an uprising. If the sense were that the generals are sitting in the rear with the gear, protecting themselves and having a nice cushy job, while we're out here risking our lives, it would be immensely unpopular. So the Russian military doctrine is rather different. The generals need to be out in the front.
Yeah, well, I guess if you're leading from the front lines, you know, they used to do that, like in the Civil War. Hey, even in World War One, you saw it, but that's all changed. But interesting phenomena that, you know, all this top brass can be considered expendable in a war. But maybe they know something that we don't. So financially, looking at it, this break, you think Italy is going to go cut a deal with the Russians and get the gas for the winter?
I think there's a strong likelihood that they're going to put pressure on the European Union to scale back their ambitions in terms of shutting off the Russians and following a very anti-Russian line. So we've seen certain countries like Russia, Hungary and the Czech Republic move a bit in that direction. Not so much Poland or the Baltic states, but certainly Hungary has been somewhat suspect. They feel very exposed to not being able to get Russian oil and Russian gas, and so have certain exemptions worked out there. I think the Italians are more of that mindset, more Hungarian, not just in terms of Russia and energy, but I think more broadly, philosophically aligned there. I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm coming across now as sounding very pro-Russian, which I'm not at all.
Hey,
but I'm just trying to be as impartial as possible on it.
Sure.
Yeah, but I think in general, the news we get here is quite similar to yours as well. and the basic news is this is a war started by one man, and it's Putin, and he's insane, and no one can stop him. And somehow this one insane, deranged individual is able to drag an enormous country in his wake and get everyone to do what he wants. I don't know how people imagine political institutions work or how that's even possible to think about. One man cannot do that. He needs broad institutional support, and he needs the support of a large segment of the population, maybe not a majority, and maybe not an enthusiastic majority, but at least needs sort of tacit consent that this is better than the alternative and move forward on that basis. One guy can't do it. It's an absurd idea.
Yeah, I'm with you. Hey, so what about the euro? The euro has been sinking pretty fast here. It's, you know, well below the dollar. It's good.
Well, listen, I just thought about there's like a real silver lining to all these currency realignments, and that, you know, it used to be so difficult. You went from one country to the next in Europe, and you to the US, and you had to calculate different exchange rates. Now, that back in the day, the Deutschmark and the French franc, that was just impossible to do. You had to
always and the lira.
And the lira, and who knew what that was worth? You know, that was always going down. But now it seems that all these currencies, for whatever reason, are sort of converging on parity, and they're all worth about the same thing. So $1 is one Swiss franc, is €1, is £1. It's amazing. So it has the silver lining of being pretty easy to travel around.
Yeah,
now the negative side of it is that. For US exporters, it makes their exports very expensive, so they'll get punished. The imports become cheaper. Mm-hmm. For the Europeans, it's going to be really bad because a lot of commodities are denominated in dollars, like oil, and that's going to loans and things like that drives them up. So I think the Europeans are going to get the short end of the stick here, and the British in particular, as you see their currencies melt away, and that's going to stoke inflation in their markets again because it becomes more expensive to import things. And sure. So that's going to be inflationary spiral, and maybe it is overblown at this stage, but certainly it's going to push inflation further in the EU and in the UK.
Yeah, definitely. I understand exactly where you're coming from on that score. It's going to cause all sorts of problems that nobody is thinking of at this particular moment. But at some point, you got to think about it, and that's why we're doing it for you. Hey, Octavio, appreciate your coming on, giving us the European perspective on what's going on in your continent there. And it's going to be interesting when the truth finally comes out and we really get an idea of what the heck is happening here. I can't wait for that. In the meantime, you got a question for Octavio, shoot us an email, kl@kerrylutz.com. Link to Octavio's site is in the show notes. This interview on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. And just click the subscribe button for our newsletter. Octavio, really appreciate your stopping by. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Thank you so much, Kerry. Enjoy speaking.
Thanks for listening to Kerry Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.